welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
Something sick like spin effects, dumb like ants on honey, like money on stuff.
Spinifex Gum, a choir made up of young Indigenous women, performed a choral plea for voice, treaty and truth to greet returning parliamentarians in Canberra yesterday. Singing with passion and pride, they added a colourful note to the formalities of parliamentary proceedings. Also on The Wire today...
Women do fulfil the bulk of the caring work, and so when you have women's mental health that's compromised, you potentially have all of that support coming undone.
This September, people are fundraising to help bring awareness to and resources for women's mental health one lipstick at a time. Georgina Dent from the Women's Agenda explains why women's mental health is so important. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, yesterday, with the support of Labor, Centre Alliance and Jackie Lambie, the Greens passed a bill in the Senate to establish a federal anti-corruption commission. With One Nation abstaining, the bill passed 35-32 and is headed to the lower house, where it will almost certainly be rejected by the government. The government instead wants to focus on introducing drug testing for welfare recipients, quarantining welfare payments for those who test positive and forcing them onto a cashless card system to prevent them from spending money on alcohol, drugs, gambling or anything. The Wire's Dominic Giannini spoke to Warringah's independent MP Zali Stegall and asked her about the need for a federal version of ICAC.
Anthony Albanese came out a little while ago saying he saw no evidence of corruption in federal politics. Given the revelations about the New South Wales Labor Party, is this just federal politicians being out of touch?
The irony is the Federal Labor Party have supported the institution of a Federal Anti-Corruption Commission, so I don't understand that position to have changed, so I think that may have been, I don't know the context of his answer to and what the question exactly was, but my understanding is under Shorten, they did support a National Anti-Corruption Commission. At the end of the day, we know both parties have dragged the chain when it comes to implementing a National Anti-Corruption Commission, and there's been a number of issues from both sides of the political spectrum that have raised serious concerns with the public as to the integrity of our processes. And the only way we can clear that up and regain, I think it's really important that the public regain faith in its political system and its decision-making system and how very large contracts are awarded to ensure that there is no undue influence or interest, personal interest or conflicts of interest coming into play when very serious decisions are being made in relation to taxpayer money.
So in your short time in Parliament so far, have you seen evidence of corruption at the federal level?
Oh, no, I certainly wouldn't be drawn into pointing fingers or doing anything of the sort. But what I do know is that the faith and trust in our politicians is at an all-time low. Now, that's a problem because at the end of the day, we are elected to represent our electorates and we're there to do a certain job. And if at the end of the day, people have no faith in the decisions being made or how things are being implemented or the use of their tax hard-earned dollars, that the government collects in taxes are being put to use, then that's a real problem.
So the economy seems to be floundering at the moment, with Australia bracing for with the worst economic growth in over a decade. What do you think the government's next move should be? Should they protect the surplus or should they increase spending? Was this the right time for the tax cuts to go through then?
Well, look, I think they're still waiting to see the effect of the tax cuts in terms of whether that will stimulate the economy. I support the tax cuts, but I don't think that's enough. We think we need to do more. The evidence is there that, for example, a raise to Newstart would certainly stimulate the economy because it would would essentially flow through back to the economy. So that's another way you can boost it. I'm a big proponent for we need to increase childcare support payments so that we we can have a better even playing field when it comes to women's participation in the workforce, and so that we can start diminishing the pay gap that we have between men and women. Now, the other interesting aspect is that all these measures are identified as would be of a great stimulating effect to the economy. So I think the government has a fantastic opportunity to achieve two things in one go. You can create great social reform, you can rectify a need and an imbalance that is in place, and at the same time you can stimulate the economy.
So the government is set to reintroduce its drug tests for welfare recipients, and those that fail it will go onto a cashless card. What are your thoughts about this? Will you be speaking to the Senate crossbench?
Of course, I'm keen to get the views of a number of my colleagues to understand their position on that proposal. I do also need to talk to some experts in the field to understand where the recommendation is coming from and why it's believed that this is the right approach.
So if welfare recipients are to be drug tested, shouldn't this be the same for members of parliament?
Well, you raise an interesting question. Look, I should say in the corporate world, there is a lot of organisations that require drug tests and the like. So there you go. Look, I come from a sporting background and I was on the anti-doping panel, so I don't have any issues with drug testing.
Okay, and then just quickly to some state politics. So the New South Wales Parliament pushed back the controversial abortion bill, and of course some federal members like Barnaby Joyce and your former rival Tony Abbott have voiced their opinion. So obviously this is a state issue and you're a federal MP, but has this been a big deal in your electorate? Have you had constituents come up and have been encouraging you to speak out on one way or another?
Oh, look, I have indicated my support, and I'm extremely pleased with the action that our Premier has taken in putting forward this legislation. I think it's long overdue. The health of women should be in the hands of women and doctors. This should not be a criminal matter. These are extremely difficult circumstances and decisions. That certain federal male MPs feel entitled to comment is, I think, completely unfortunate.
Warringah MP Zali Stegall ending that report from Dominic Giannini. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian has announced plans to lift Sydney's controversial lockout laws. But there's a catch. Although the CBD will have the laws limiting lockouts to 1:30 a.m. lifted, King's Cross will continue to have the limitations in place. Critics of the announcement will also have questioned the Premier's motivations behind it. Kevin Suarez has more.
They've been blamed for the slow death of Sydney's nightlife. Bars have closed because of it, and people are no longer willing to visit the CBD late at night. But Sydney's lockout laws may soon be a thing of the past if Premier Gladys Berejiklian's announcement over the weekend is anything to go by. However, while the CBD's plans to be rid of the lockout laws, King's Cross will still be keeping them. The reasons are unknown, and some have criticised the Premier for making the announcement when the results of committee reports into Sydney's nightlife are not yet known. But have the laws been effective up until now? Dr. Renee Zanow, lecturer in criminology at the University of Queensland, explains more.
There has been a number of reports done by KPMG that suggest that they have. Overall, other evidence that has been conducted in other places would suggest that lockouts alone do not have that effect. So there's only three studies that I know of that have looked at lockouts as a standalone strategy to reduce violence, and none of them actually found that violence and certainly injuries relating to alcohol-fueled violence reduced as a result of those lockouts.
The announcement that the laws will be rolled back has been received positively by some, including the Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney, Jess Scully. However, she feels the announcement is still light on some details.
I think it's a really hopeful sign that the Premier has acknowledged the huge impact that her government's lockout laws have had on Sydney. They've had a devastating impact on venues, nightlife, live music scene, on employment and the economy of the city. It's absolutely time, it's well past time for the lockout laws to be reviewed and to be rolled back. But there is no real detail around what the Premier is proposing, and there's no transparent reason why a place like King's Cross might be excluded. There's still a lot more information that needs to be delivered.
Sydney's nightlife has struggled during the lockout laws. Deputy Lord Mayor Scully says rolling back the laws to encourage a more vibrant nightlife in the CBD would be beneficial to the city.
We've provided almost $1 million in funding to nightlife venues. We've done everything in our power to support nightlife, and we think it's one of the most important things we can do for Sydney's morale, for Sydney's reputation, and for Sydney's economy, and for Sydney's culture. So if the government did come to its senses and roll back the lockout laws in the CBD, it would be wonderful for Sydney.
The lockout laws haven't been perfect, as Dr. Zanel describes one major issue with them.
The biggest problem with lockout is that the service of alcohol continues, and the people who are still in the venue being served alcohol need to go home at some time. So we haven't actually stopped alcohol being served. It's just that you've stopped people moving about.
With movement restricted after 1:30 a.m, Dr. Zanel outlines what changes needs to be made to the city to be able to cope with a safer nightlife.
I think that it's really about taking certainly these approaches where we have multiple departments working together, working with other government departments like health, to ensure that the nighttime economy is something that's very safe. So I think that there is a desire from younger age groups for a broader kind of types of entertainment in the nighttime space. So I think having nice restaurants, having lots of different things to do that are not centred around drinking is also important. But certainly I think earlier rollback of alcohol, responsible drinking and a change in culture.
Yes, Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney, Jess Scully, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. Liptember is a campaign that runs through the month of September and calls on people to purchase lipstick, which raises funds for women's mental health via charities like Are You OK, Lifeline and the Jean Hales Foundation. Since 2011, Liptember has funded over 80,000 support requests, renovated mental health care centres and funded research into mental health and more. Samantha Smith spoke to the Women's Agenda contributing editor Georgina Dent about why we need to focus on women's mental health. She asked Georgina, why is Liptember an important campaign?
There is a huge deal of merit in anything that increases awareness and conversations around the incidence of mental health.
A huge reason as to why Liptember started their campaign is because they found research around mental health was predominantly based on men, and therefore treatment was male-centric but applied to women. Do you think this is problematic?
Well, I think that in virtually every field of medicine, it has been shown that there is a disparity between treatment and outcomes for men and women. A lot of the pharmaceutical testing, for example, is done on men, and it hasn't always necessarily been done on women, and therefore there is a skew or a bias that's there. That I think there's now more awareness around that. So I don't think that it's surprising that in mental health there has been a sort of a difference between the way males and females are treated and the way that those treatments have been tailored.
And what mental health issues are unique to women that can't be researched around men, for example?
I don't know whether I would agree necessarily with that statement, but I think what you can probably say is that men's and women's experiences are statistically often quite different. And I think anyone who's familiar with the figures will know that actually suicide among men, particularly young men, is dire and diabolical. And so I think that is an area that absolutely needs a lot of resources and research. I think that one of the things we know very clearly is that men and women do have different experiences in life. And I think one of the sort of fundamental issues that women face that men don't is that the sort of financial pressure and the gendered nature of our workplaces means that for a lot of women, they're dealing with overwhelm. We know very clearly that women are doing far more paid work and unpaid work than men. And that means that they're operating with less capacity than other people. And in that sort of instance, if there is a mental health condition, it sort of those conditions would make it ripe.
how do you think poor mental health in women affects the wider Australian population?
We do know that women do fulfil sort of the bulk of the caring work. And so when you have women's mental health that's compromised, you potentially have all of that support coming undone, because if individual women aren't in a position to sort of do the caring that is sort of expected of them, then who is going to step up? And then that obviously has a flow-on effect.
Liptember says by popping on the lipstick, you can help get the conversation started around mental health. How else do you think we can do that?
Well, I mean, I think that the way that any of us can try and help address these issues is by keeping an eye out for the people around us, by being really honest with ourselves about our own mental health, about reaching out to people to be honest about your own struggles. I think all of these things, you know, having really open, frank conversations with friends and family is one important way that we can sort of bring mental health out of the shadows. As I said at the beginning, I think any initiative or campaign that's designed to increase awareness around mental health is terrific. I'm not sure necessarily whether a single sort of lipstick is going to be able to achieve that. But I certainly think that the motivation is terrific, and that I think if it encourages more people to think about how they either address their own mental health or how they respond to those around them who may be experiencing mental health issues, I think that's a terrific thing.
Georgina Dent, contributing editor of Women's Agenda, speaking there with Samantha Smith. And if you know anyone or you yourself need help, then contact Lifeline on 131114. Did you know that in some regions of Australia, 1 in 10 people will die because of heat? A recent study published in the Climate Change Journal has justified our concerns over rising temperatures. Andrew Herlinger spoke with Dr. Thomas Longton, Senior Research Fellow at CHERE, and asked him to explain why his study had contradicted previously completed research.
Compared to the previous studies, I use a similar methodology. So the statistical analysis is almost the same. The change that I've made, other than looking at different data sets, is to actually use a different reference temperature. So when I define heat and cold, I always split the temperature distribution into 50-50, where previous studies, because they're using a statistical process to actually set that reference temperature, they can come up with different percentages of heat compared to the cold. And for Australia, those previous studies had found that, those previous studies had used a lot more days to define cold than heat. It was all about the way they were referring to the reference temperature and defining what was a hot day compared to what was a cold day.
Your study stated that climate change creates a benefit in reducing cold weather deaths. Can you elaborate how this benefit occurs?
So because I look at different climate zones, I actually find different results for whether the heat or the cold are more dangerous, depending on the climate zone. So for the hotter climate zones, those cold days, so the bottom 50% of the temperature distribution, are actually not that cold. So I actually find that those types of days have a negative impact on the number of deaths that occur compared to the median temperature that happens during the day.
Our increasing temperatures are coinciding with a rise in bushfires. Is there any relationship between the two that should concern Australians?
So the question of bushfires starts getting into also rainfall. So definitely temperatures are a concern with bushfires, but then you also have to remember that part of the problem with bushfires and part of the dangers that are occurring right now is that the increase in temperatures, so the hotter temperatures, are also coinciding with a period where there has been a lack of rainfall, which means that the bush is relatively dry, or we can say very dry, and that's why some of the recent bushfires have broken out. And definitely there are a lot of studies that are coming out saying that those dangers are going to increase in the future.
In what ways would policy change influence the outlook for Australia's climate zones?
So one of the things that I've been trying to discuss about these results is that actually the health policy response will be different across different climate zones. So one of the important things with this, one of the important findings of this research and the implications of these findings is that different climate zones across Australia will have more dangers either during the heat and the hot summers, and some climate zones will have more dangers during the cold weather, which means that we need a response in health policies that is different across the different climate zones. And we also need an improvement in building standards that improve thermal comfort in the home. And in some climate zones, that might be during the summer, and in other climate zones, that will be during the winter.
Just quickly before we go, are there any further issues that you would wish to raise?
So I think one of the things that's been quite interesting about doing this research is seeing how different the results have been across different climate zones. And one of the things that I encourage people to do is to go out and have a look at the local efforts that are occurring to adapt and adjust to climate change and extreme temperatures. I think people will be quite surprised by how many energy, health and other policies are out there trying to protect local communities from what is actually happening to our climate. And that includes temperatures, it includes sort of rainfall, bushfires and other dangers that are going to increase and change due to climate change.
Dr. Thomas Longdon, a Senior Research Fellow at SHARE, speaking there with Andrew Herlinger. In Canberra yesterday, returning parliamentarians were greeted by a choral plea from an exuberant choir of young Indigenous women. Their song, Dream Baby Dream, is a musical contribution to the campaign for a treaty and an Indigenous voice in Parliament. An imaginative variation on campaigning techniques, members of the public were invited to record themselves singing lines from the song, and these recordings were then incorporated into the final mix of the track. Rob Hosborne has the story.
Was Indigenous youth choir Spinifex Gum and the Malia Choir performing in the Marble Hall at Parliament House yesterday as parliamentarians in both houses returned to Canberra from the winter break. The song, Dream Baby Dream, is a plea for a treaty and for an Indigenous voice to be enshrined in the Constitution. Vinyl copies of the song were presented to Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Ken Wyatt, and Labor Senator Patrick Dodson. The song is also the culmination of a novel method of online campaigning. Thomas Mayer is a prominent advocate for the Uluru Statement from the Heart and participated in the online process that contributed to the final recording. Here he is explaining how this aspect of the campaign was organised.
It was organised by Felix of Cat Empire, and basically it's a matter of putting everybody's voices together. I mean, it's using new technology in a way that, you know, does a petition that's different and inspiring. So I had a go, and I'm not a very good singer, but that doesn't matter when your voice is joined up to 11,000 at the moment it is. So yesterday they presented a vinyl record of all of those voices singing together with Spinifex Gum and the Malia Choir.
Thomas Mayer says that the collaboration that was a feature of the Dream Baby Dream campaign reflects the process that produced the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which involved 12 regional consultative meetings around Australia. The recording follows the release of Spinifex Gum's first album, a collaborative exercise facilitated by Felix Reibel from Cat Empire. Here he is describing the approach they adopted.
We really wanted to invert what a choir traditionally does. We wanted to make a choir sound like a lead, tough pop vocal, but still sound lush and beautiful at the same time. Come on
and dream, baby, dream. This version of Dream Baby Dream, originally a Bruce Springsteen song, contains verses translated into Indigenous language. This is another important element in the choral compositions. Here's a member of the choir explaining what she enjoys most about the project.
Language songs. I really like the language songs, especially the language songs where there's dance involved.
16-year-old Indigenous South Sea woman and choir member Grace Miller said at Parliament yesterday that it was overwhelming knowing that so many people support the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and this was cause for optimism. I asked Thomas Mayer what impact he hopes the Canberra performance and the online participation will have.
Well, I'd just like to see many, many more voices join ours so that the government changes their point of view and more vigorously pursues a constitutionally enshrined First Nations voice. At the moment, they're trying to separate constitutional recognition from the voice, but constitutional recognition that is less than a voice to Parliament is not accepted by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. That has been our response a number of times now. It must be substantive reform.
Here's the rousing conclusion to the choir's impassioned performance in Parliament yesterday.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.